This is the Hollywood Outsider, and welcome to a special Inside the Movie episode of our show, where we are going to talk solely about the Marvel film The Amazing Spider-Man 2, or Do, depending on which way you look at it, where it fits in the Spider-Man mythology, as well as the movie itself. Don't worry if you thought you were downloading the latest normal episode of our show. It is still there. Just go back and download it, or wait around for the next. Well, don't wait around. I guess that would make you silly, just hanging around. But there will be another episode on Thursday, as always. So just go to thehollywoodoutsider.com, iTunes, or Stitcher, and find more of our comedic stylings there. If you have not already seen The Amazing Spider-Man 2 and you want to remain spoiler-free, we would recommend now is a good time to come back to this episode later, because we're going to talk about everything that happens in the movie. But right now, let's get into the episode. Spoilers are officially allowed. And let's welcome my fellow host, Brian Williams.
Hey, now, did we watch Amazing Spider-Man 2 or 3?
Amazing. Yeah, I was wondering that as well.
Did I say 2, 3?
No, you said 2, but your little email that you sent out says 3.
Well, so, as you should know, ignore everything I write.
I was wondering if I walked out of the movie too soon, maybe the rest of it. Maybe it was a double feature I wasn't aware of. Like the little stinger at the end of the credits was actually a whole other movie.
So. And I don't remember seeing any emo dancing in it either. So.
Oh, that's I just rewatched that. Oh, by the way, Scott Clark as well. He's here too.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. And yeah, I just rewatched Spider-Man 3. I got to tell you, that movie is not so bad if you take all the emo stuff out of it. Like where he's smacking Mary Jane around and everything. That's actually not a bad movie.
Gets a worse rap than what it really is.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. But let's get into it. Let's talk about The Amazing Spider-Man 2. It's finally out. A lot of people have seen it. It had a pretty big weekend. And just to preface where we stand, we all three liked it to varying degrees. We're not going to review it for this, but that'll be on a normal show. But we didn't all love it. So I think Scott actually liked it more than all of us, and he's the more diehard comic book fan.
Yeah, I think I enjoyed it quite a bit more than I expected to. So we'll obviously get into a bigger review when we do the proper show. But
yeah, that'll be episode 141 if you haven't listened to it yet. That's where the Spider-Man review is. But let's get into this movie. Okay, let's start with the opening, the parent subplot, which was part of the last film. And now they've expanded it and made it a huge part of this film. In fact, we have an entire James Bond-style plane opening. What did you think, Scott? Did this work for you? Did this take you aback? How did this play for you?
It was a weird intro as far as not what I expected. I kind of expected just to see, like, you know, Spider-Man falling like in the trailer or something. I didn't even know this was going to be a subplot at all, other than the little bit we got from the trailer. But I thought it was really action-packed and really enjoyable and edgy and exciting. And I mean, you kind of knew exactly what was going to happen. But the thing that bugged me about it was the suspension of disbelief that you kind of had to go with it. Like, I don't know. Have you ever gotten a Wi-Fi signal on a plane that wasn't crashing? I can't imagine like this plane spiraling down and just getting a really good connection to download or upload whatever it is they're uploading.
Well, no, he was plugging it in. He was hardwired.
Yeah, as the plane ripped apart, he was still hardwired,
well,
apparently.
I mean, that's of course that's where the suspension of disbelief. But I mean, you mentioned Wi-Fi, so I didn't. He was actually plugging in. Of course, I don't know where you've got your wits about you. Where the plane's going down, there's a gaping hole that's sucking everything out the side of the airplane. Your wife's unconscious or dead or something, and you've got the wherewithal to, hey, let me make sure I get this little. You know, this little cable, get this plugged in so I can hit restart.
Well, yeah, but even if he was hardwired in, the plane wasn't. I mean, the plane.
That's true.
Yeah, it was plummeting to the earth. That's where the plane was. It was going.
Yeah, but the internet signal doesn't have anything to do with the trajectory of the plane.
Okay, here's where I'm a huge Spider-Man fan. I'll be the first to admit it. And I didn't care about the parent subplot in the first movie, and I care less about it in this one. But I have a hard time imagining Peter Parker's parents are spies or special agents. And, I mean, that's really, you know, I get it. They're scientists and, oh, there's this geneticist research. We have to get out there because Oscorp is doing some crazy stuff. I get that. You could have had all that information without any of the subplot. And it was so ludicrous on this plane because you've got the guy, you know, who kills the pilot, comes in, tries to kill them. And then you've got him managing to keep all this information flowing on his laptop while a plane is crashing. I mean, it basically, you took disbelief and I stepped on it. I mean, that's how much I had to take it out of my head.
Well, even to get real nitpicky, as far as the assassin guy, how good of an assassin is this guy if he's washing his bloody hands 3 feet from?
I was just gonna say that.
From his face, I'm like, how do you?
Hey, what are you doing? Nothing, nope, man.
Nothing. Hey, you know those steaks? They're a little bit bloody. Yeah, but you're up in the cockpit. Yeah.
We got a barbecue up front. Oh God, it was so ridiculous.
It's out on the veranda.
This is one of those things where when they were testing this movie, they should have removed all of this. None of this was necessary. Just pop it out.
There was a lot of little scenes like that in the movie, though, that they paid very close attention to for no reason. And we'll get to it later when we talk about the villains. But there's so many little things. Like, why did you waste the time to do that?
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't need to be there. Like you said, Parker notices his hand is bloody.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you washing your hands? Oh, like Brian said, I've been tenderizing some of the steaks, getting ready for the in-flight meal. You know,
you never know. And the fact that Parker is Mr. Parker, we're just gonna call him Mr. Parker because he's Pappy Parker. And this guy apparently turns into Jason Bourne when his life is in danger and manages through all this chaos. He's a scientist. He's not a tough guy. He's a scientist. And through all this chaos, manages to restrap himself back into his chair, enough composure to take out his laptop and continue downloading this while he's crashing. It's just, my brain kept hurting trying to watch this scene. It really did.
And usually in these kind of movies, you kind of check your brain a little bit. You know, we are talking about a superhero movie and a guy that shoots, you know, webs from his wrists, but when it's distracting from the story, it's a little bit of a problem.
Yeah, I think it's saying a lot. I believe more that a guy can have web shooters and fly through the city than I do that this guy can strap himself in and connect to the
Wi-Fi.
Well,
but according to the rules of the movies and stuff, they set that up with the last movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they showed him, you know, inventing that, you know, that gear and that kind of stuff and trying it out and testing it and research and development and all that kind of stuff. So they've set that up. We've established, okay, we don't have to worry about figuring out why he's shooting webs from his wrist. You know, it's an invention. So mm-hmm. it's that groundwork has been laid, but as far as his dad, like you said, is Jason Bourne, you know, or a Mission Impossible or something. It's the one word that really kind of rings throughout this whole movie is why.
Yeah, I get mm-hmm. you. But we'll get into that part. We just wanted to talk about the parents subplot a lot. What's your complete opinion on this? Was the parents subplot necessary? I say no, Brian.
Not in the remotest reason. It should have been in there. Could have just, absolutely could have and probably should have cut all of that out.
And Scott?
I hadn't really thought about it until you mentioned it, but I'm thinking through the movie in my head, the rest of the movie would work just fine without that, I think. I think you could still have the story with the dad and him leaving this information, but I'm torn because I found this scene really exciting. You know what I mean? It was well done. The plane crashing.
Yeah, I had some emotion and stuff. I mean, you know, that blurred moving fast vision and that soft light and it's and that impending doom. And it's like, the scene itself, if you just take that out and just watch that, it was a very good scene. It mm-hmm. just belonged in a different movie.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what about Peter Parker? I mean, a lot of people keep comparing Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield. That may or may not be fair. That's up to you, the film goer, I think. But as far as we're concerned, how do you think he's doing in the role as Peter Parker and Spider-Man?
I think he totally owns the role. He's got that snarky, you know, snarky bit. I think Andrew Garfield is as much as Spider-Man as Hugh Jackman is Wolverine or Christopher Reeve is Superman. To me, he is Spider-Man.
I'm with you. I'm absolutely with you. That opening, the opening scene with Rhino, or soon to be Rhino, with Paul Giamatti, you know, the opening chase scene where Spider-Man just falls out of the air and then he's slapping wisecracks left and right. He's taking phone calls from Gwen Stacy. He's making constant remarks while he's swinging around, making jokes to the villain. That was Spider-Man to me.
Mm-hmm.
And every scene that he does Peter Parker, I feel like he's got a good grasp of the character. I think he's not quite as nerdy as he was in the comic book, but he's taking Peter Parker into the modern day. This is where Peter Parker would be today, you know, and I think he nails it, man. I like Tobey Maguire. I love Andrew Garfield.
Yeah, I pretty much feel the same way. I think Andrew Garfield is better as Spider-Man than he is as Peter Parker. Not saying that I think he does a poor job. It just feels like a different character than I'm familiar with, and obviously I didn't read the comics as much as you guys. I've seen a couple, but he seems almost... It's not even necessarily a bad thing. He's almost too pretty to be a Peter Parker. You know what I'm saying?
He's almost too pretty.
I think of Peter Parker as just like a nerdy, like you said, nerdy or, you know, more reserved kind of, not loser, but just more. And he's a good looking guy. I don't picture Peter Parker as being a model.
You know, yeah. Well, you know, back in, you know, the earlier years of Spider-Man comic books, I mean, he was picked on. Mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. Wasn't it Flash Thompson
Flash Thompson, yeah.
Used to pick on him. So he was a bit more of a weakling and a nerd. But nowadays, it's basically cool to be a nerd. So I think he kind of fits.
Okay, that makes sense.
He does. And I guess he does have that model-like coiffed hair and whatnot. I mean, that really high hair he's got going on is fantastic. I don't know how that stays up like that.
Wait, what's that word you just used?
Coiffed.
Coiffed.
Is it coif?
Quaff? I don't know. I'm not a thesaurus. Whatever it is, it's a fantastic head of hair he's got going on.
Those went out with the meteors and stuff years ago, didn't they?
Shut your hole. He's definitely got a grasp on that. And I get what you're saying. I think Toby probably had the nerdy part down a little bit. But like I said, I think Andrew Garfield is kind of making this a Spider-Man or a Peter Parker for the modern age, where geeks right. aren't necessarily the minority. They aren't exiled. They aren't looked down on, you know, they're part of the community nowadays. And I think he has that down, and he's such a better crier. I'm sorry.
Oh yeah.
If you're going to cry, Tobey Maguire always looked like he was in pain. You know what I mean? Every time he was crying, he's like, oh, has he got a kidney thing going on or maybe a gallbladder attack? What's going on with Toby?
Well, his is so bad that they made a meme about it. Like there's a meme floating around the internet of the scene of him crying from Spider-Man and you can put whatever caption you want under it. It was bad.
Yeah, but
not Claire Danes bad. But
whoa, why you got to bring Claire Danes into this, man? Why you got to rip on her? Does she play Peter Parker? Maybe she could play him in the next Patricia Parker.
To me, she's just like notoriously really poor at crying. I never buy her crying. As I was comparing her.
We should change this into a Claire Danes podcast right now.
Let's do it.
All right. Well, speaking of ladies, Gwen Stacy's role. Do you think Emma Stone in this role? Do you think she accomplishes more than just the superhero girlfriend?
I think so. I think she was very pivotal to the story. I mean, I kind of checked out a little bit when she started wanting to get involved in actually. Helping mm-hmm. him and this kind of stuff. It was like, come on.
You're a bit too pushy. Come on.
Yeah.
You can't jump around and swing all over the city like I can. Back up.
I mean, granted, her job was to flip a switch, but still, like, you know, that's pretty much all she did if you boil it down. But
the thing I liked about her, especially in this movie, is she actually came up with several things that saved the hero. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like the whole how he stopped Electro was really her idea. Right. And that was nice and refreshing to see, because I get so sick of the damsel in distress thing. And especially the original trilogy, where Mary Jane was, you know, being dangled from something every movie.
At least once, twice
yeah,
in every movie.
Exactly. And never really offered anything to help Spider-Man. I mean, really, if you had to pick a bride, I think Mary Jane would be the least one he'd want to pick, because she's always going to be in jeopardy, man. You already got enough stuff to do. You got to worry about her all the time.
Well, that's something I've wanted to ask you guys, because I've never read the comics. And to me, Mary Jane was always the love interest or the girl in the movies and the comics. I didn't even know Gwen Stacy was a character until the third movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like a completely different character from Spider-Man 3 and this. Where does that fall into the lore of Spider-Man? Like, what happened to Mary Jane in the comics? And
These movies are more apropos to where Gwen Stacy fit. Well, it's hard, because she was part of his high school romance, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And she did get killed in the comic book. She was, I think, dropped from the George Washington Bridge, I think is what it was, by mm-hmm. Green Goblin. So it's very similar. In fact, I swear she's wearing the same outfit that she wore in the comics, in the movie, the same outfit that she dies in.
Oh, really? That's kind of cool.
Yeah, and then he ended up romancing Mary Jane Watson and married her in the comics. So they're both right, I guess. Gwen Stacy in Spider-Man 3 came in way later than she would have in the original, than she would have. Here, okay. It seems more fitting because Mary Jane came in after Gwen.
Gotcha. Okay.
Is that right, Brian? Am I right?
Yeah. Mary Jane. Yeah. Gwen comes before in the timeline before Mary Jane. So, yeah, this is more fitting of the traditional, I guess, history of Spider-Man.
And I love Emma Stone. I think she should play every superhero's girlfriend from here on out.
See, I'm in the minority.
You didn't like her?
I liked her character, and I liked how she portrayed her character, you know, in this role. But you guys, all three of you, from what y'all have got mad love for her that I just don't get. I like her. I appreciate her. I think she's a good actress. I don't know. Just one of those people I see way too much of that I just go, oh, okay, here, she's in this one or he's in that one. You know, it's like she's almost like a female Shia LaBeouf in the sense that not hated like LaBeouf, but just she pops up in everything. Right. I mean, that's a nod to her skills because she's good, but she's just one of those that I just don't really care about, but yet she's in everything I freaking turn on. So
I don't want to picture Emma Stone walking around with a bag on her head. I just don't. Now, what about Peter and Gwen's relationship? I mean, you've got the ghost of Gwen's dad, Dennis Leary, popping up, and you've got this whole, I'm going to go to Oxford, I'm not going to go to Oxford, maybe I'll go with you to London. That whole, how did that work for you? Was it getting a little annoying, or did you love it?
Well, I don't know. I think that as far as Gwen's dad, I think you probably could have done the same thing with her dad that you could have with his parents. Give a 15-second flashback to something, and that way it just kind of reminds you that this happened in the last movie, and then you kind of move on from there. But to see him pop up every time he turned around, I get the intent, and that was just that say that this is always on his mind, that this is always, you know, this was a promise he made to his dad, to her dad, you know, and I get that. It just felt like, I guess 2.5 hours of that was just felt like I was being beat over the head with it.
It felt a little like Ross and Rachel. They're on again, they're off again. They kept breaking up with each other. I'm breaking up with you.
Right.
But I love the element of Dennis Leary's character, her dad, just showing up, never said a word. The entire movie just kind of stared at him, making him feel guilty.
Mm-hmm.
That was awesome. I liked that a lot. I mean, you got that just a little bit with the old Spider-Man movies, like with with great power comes great responsibility, and I have to protect those and this kind of thing. The only person he was really even worried about protecting was her. It felt like a real relationship. I never really bought that Peter Parker and Mary Jane were a thing in the original movies. I just felt like, kind of like you said, the damsel in distress, just to have a girl there that he's got to save, kind of thing. I never really bought that they were in love. Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield really sold me on their relationship. It was the most important thing to both of them.
Their chemistry was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
They have great chemistry. And anybody else did anybody watch Rescue Me when it was on?
Mm-mm.
A few episodes.
Because in Rescue Me, Dennis Leary's character constantly sees his cousin's ghost. And I kept thinking that every time he'd pop up. I'm like, is this like him redoing his own show in Spider-Man? I don't understand where this came from. But you're right, Scott. I mean, it didn't need to be there. I mean, you could just say, I got to remember my promise to your dad without him creepily popping up everywhere and throwing things for a loop. But their relationship is the best relationship, I think, in the movie, and it works well. In fact, it's a better romance story than I've seen in a lot of movies.
Mm-hmm.
So now we can have a little bit more fun because we're going to talk about Harry Osborn and his goofy-ass genetic disorder that his dad lets him know about, but apparently he doesn't know he has until his dad mentions it. Hey, is your hand shaking? Oh, shit, it is, Dad. Crap.
The power of suggestion.
Exactly. So what did you think about this whole introducing or reintroducing Harry Osborn? What do you think about this new Dane DeHaan playing him versus James Rebel Without a Clue Franco? What did you think?
Rebel Without a Clue. I actually liked him. Although I think he looks like a younger Leonardo DiCaprio.
He really does. Yeah,
he does.
I can't help but think of him as Leonardo DiCaprio every time, and he's got those weird mannerisms of, say, like a name is wrong. The guy that played the Scarecrow in the Batman movies. What's his name?
Cillian Murphy.
Yeah, Cillian Murphy. He's got those kind of mannerisms, but looks like another actor. So I'm always kind of distracted. But I also bought it again. I'm always comparing this movie to the previous movies. But I bought him as him and Peter as being buddies a lot more than Harry and Peter in the previous movies. Although, where did this whole we haven't talked in 8 years? Now that you're dying, let's hang out and be buddies.
Let's reconcile. Let's do this again.
In the middle of a board meeting, and I don't know. I didn't get that, but I actually like the story element of the father having this disease that basically made him look like the Green Goblin. To me, that makes more sense in this universe of Spider-Man, as opposed to, you know, the dad's got multiple personality disorder and then he dies, and you know what I mean? It although there's no description of what his condition really was, other than it just killed him and turned him green and gave him long fingernails.
I couldn't stop laughing. Seriously. I liked Dane DeHaan. I thought he does a very nice job, even though his hair is seriously cut that hair. What the hell, emo guy? I mean, you look like Tobey Maguire in Spider-Man 3, really.
Yeah, he definitely brought the emo factor, you know, from the third movie.
Yeah.
It was like if Leonardo DiCaprio had Eddie Furlong's hair from the Terminator movie.
And just the whole, when he comes back and he's sitting with his dad, and his dad is fucking green, and he sits down with his dad, and his dad's like,
hey. Like the Grinch.
He does. I was just waiting for a little Jim Carrey joke.
Was that Chris Cooper, by the way?
That was Chris Cooper. And the fact that we're cheated out of a Chris Cooper Green Goblin kind of made me sad, because I think he would have been fantastic. But when he's sitting there and he's telling him this story, and the guy's got green skin, he's got these long, curly fingernails. I mean, almost like he's out of an African tribe or something. And then you've got Dane DeHaan sitting there going, hey, Dad, what's up? And he actually just tells him, you know, hey, you're going to have this genetic disorder. I spent my whole life trying to fight it. Obviously, no one else noticed. I mean, you did a really masterful job of hiding this, billionaire guy. But, you know, you're going to have it. And he gets it within seconds of it being suggested, like Brian said. And then apparently he has the quickest representation of this sickness ever possible. I thought that was just ludicrous. I mean, I thought they rushed the Green Goblin thing quite a bit in this movie.
Well, he slowly started it, because then he started getting the handshake, and then he had like a spot on his neck that started getting it.
Well, slowly, then, by maybe your turns, but I mean, this guy's like 85 years old, and he's whatever his age is, 55 something. Mm-hmm. And he's,
well, I thought it was accelerated when he actually got the blood injected into him. That
kind of ramped it up pretty quick. But even still, it was. He did go from just like handshakes to all of a sudden he had a spot on his neck, you know, and then this is the spot is now all of a sudden the spot is growing pretty quickly, you know, after his dad, you know, right after his dad mentioned it. It was a pretty quick jump. But
and this is probably one of my biggest peeves with the movie, even though, like I said, we liked the movie. But the fact that he becomes a Green Goblin almost in seconds, it feels like. And I realized it wasn't that quick, but I mean, he masters this glider. He becomes this cackling, nonsensical villain in a matter of a quick change in the movie, and it just doesn't make sense. And the whole wanting Peter's blood, why the hell wouldn't he just give it to him? I mean, he was already dying, or he felt like he was dying, right?
Well, I think he was afraid of what it would do to him. I think Peter had an inkling that it would turn him into a supervillain. I mean, not necessarily those words, but he knew that what happened to him, he got these powers and these abilities. And he was worried that it would work, have a different effect on him, and might make him have a poor effect. That was the inkling I got from it. It was like he was worried about what it might do to him.
I understood it. I didn't buy into it. I mean, he's already dying. He seems like there's nothing else that could help him. Why wouldn't he at least let him try it and see if that might help? Maybe that will help. You never know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's just something I had an issue with. But more my issue was with the Harry Osborn character himself. I think it's probably because Emma Stone was not going to come back for a third movie, so they had to accelerate that death scene. Like, it had to happen in this movie, and they wanted to be true to the comics because it is Green Goblin that kills her.
But even still, they could have cut out so much of this other stuff and built up his story a little bit more to kind of fill in that gap, that so it didn't feel like such a jump from, hey, here's Harry, to now he's a Green Goblin.
Yeah, or keep the dad around, and he's obviously mastered the Green Goblin. Have the actual Green Goblin, because I think it was Norman Osborn in the comics, have him right. be the one that kills him, and then Harry picks up the mantle, similar to the original trilogy. It just seemed very rushed to me. Very mm-hmm. rushed to me.
I think all the villains were very rushed, because, you know, again, trying to cram so much into one movie. Like you said, mastering the glider. I mean, everybody was able to figure this stuff out right away. I mean, even the Rhino at the end, like, he had just escaped from prison, was given this armor, and knew how to operate this huge machinery.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I know there's no learning curve at all. I mean, I know that some of these people are pretty, you know, pretty smart and everything, but I mean, you throw your average person into a giant, you know, 4 million ton Rhino suit, it's probably going to take them a few days to figure it out.
Yeah, apparently not in this universe. Yeah.
You got to go to driver's ed for like months before you get a driver's license, and that's a car.
But how long does it take for a Rhino suit exactly? About a month, month and a half.
Well, you know, there's an accelerated program. You got to, you know, you got to have a driver with you. You have to, get your learner's permit first and have someone.
It's so exhausting.
Got like a simulated Rhino course that you got to go through on a computer first before they actually let you into the suit.
Yeah, exactly. It fires rubber bullets instead. You got to go around the cones, you know.
And that brings in a point, Scott, you bring it up. We were going to talk about it later, but let's talk about it now because we're already on it. Do you think there's too many villains in this movie? Is it Spider-Man 3-ish?
I don't think it's as bad as Spider-Man 3 because I actually like these villains. I didn't really care about Sandman too much, but I found Electro to be very interesting. I already knew about the Green Goblin, so I kind of felt like I knew a little bit about that character already. What I appreciated about the fight scenes in this movie is that they were not long and drawn out. The fight scenes were over very quickly, and I really appreciated that, because, to give you an example, I recently rewatched the Man of Steel,
mm-hmm.
and as much as I enjoyed that movie, that just feels like one 30-minute fight scene.
It is.
In that movie. Yeah. And I really like that, you know, villains were done in 5 minutes or less. And it didn't feel drawn out. And to me, that worked to have. If you're going to have that many villains in a movie, do it that way.
I mean, that makes sense. I never really thought about it like that. It's, if you are going to have that many, it does make sense to keep the fight scenes trimmed down. I don't know if it was necessarily too many villains. I just think it was too many stories.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Right.
I think I counted there was 6 or 7 different actual plot lines going on, not just little subplots, like hard major plot lines. And this movie's 2.5 hours and it still wasn't enough time. You would have to go Peter Jackson territory to make all of this stuff, you know, work. And it just, that really watered it down. You know, it's, you try to do 10 things at once, you end up not doing any of them, you know, anything right.
You do
one or two things. You focus on the one or two items, and you can do that very well. And I think that's kind of where they missed the boat with this movie.
I absolutely agree. I think I said in my review that the movie felt like a Spanish soap opera. I mean, there's so many plot lines they're trying to make work, and it doesn't. There's not enough screen time. You really would have to do an extended edition where there's basically 6 hours to tell the story they're trying to tell. Stories they're trying to tell. I mean, with the parents and Electro and Green Goblin and him and Gwen and him and May and all the other stuff that's going mm-hmm. on. It's like, holy crap. I don't have enough. The most ADD focused guy in America could not keep up with everything going on in this movie.
And about the time that you start getting to where you're caring about one of the plot lines, it would stop and you wouldn't see it again for a half hour.
That's true.
There's a large gap where you don't see Electro.
Right.
Or, you know, Max Dillon, whichever one, you know, but it's like, you know, it's this long intro. He's introduced a little bit later. You have a little bit of a run with him. Then you don't see him for a while. Then he's a villain. And then you really don't see him anymore after that. I don't know.
Now, speaking of characters that might have been shortchanged, what did you think about Sally Field's Aunt May? Do you think she got the short shrift?
Yeah, and this just goes back to another poor decision by, what is it, Mark Webb,
mm-hmm. the director? Mark Webb's the director, yeah.
And I'll lay it on his shoulders because he is the director, but you know, she's way more talented than what they're using her for.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
It's just, I don't know. It's like they've got their priorities a little bit mixed up there. I mean, I'm not saying it should be the Aunt May movie. God knows that will be boring, but it alluded to financial troubles. There's issues between him and her, you know, Peter and Aunt May, and that could have been expanded on a little bit. A lot. I'd be much more interested in that than I was, you know, James and Mrs. Bond playing, you know, playing super spies or whatever, or WikiLeaks. I'm not sure which one they were trying to do.
WikiLeaks. Nice.
So I just feel like she was, you know, Dennis Leary is a pretty good actor. Of course, they didn't. I kind of like what they did. I just felt they did it too much with him. Again, Chris Cooper, just that was wasted talent. It's like all you got these people that's got clout, that has, you know, whether it's experience or just whether it's history, whatever, you've got all these people that are very talented and they're hardly even used.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, Aunt May was almost, to me, used as a joke or a joke telling device, you know, like where she catches him almost in a suit, you know, obviously alluding to, oh, I almost caught him masturbating. That's really what I felt from that. Mm-hmm. And then there's a moment with his parents, and she uses it as kind of a way to tell that story. And I mean, she's obviously powerful when she tells that story about I'm your mom. And that would have worked so much better if we didn't have all that parent subplot, James Bond, hidden subway train, all that other crap.
The laundry scene.
Yes. I mean,
I washed your stuff and turned all red and blue.
It just didn't work for me. And it seems like such a waste of a talented actress who, you know, I liked Rosemary Harris in the original. I thought she did a great job. She was great as an Aunt May. And I think Sally Field has a different take on it. Mm-hmm. But I like so much of the little things she does. I wish she would have been a bigger part of the movie.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
All right, Electro. Electro. Before we talk about the actual Electro, what did you think about Jamie Foxx's almost Urkel-like take on Max Dillon pre-lab accident?
It's so hard to look at Jamie Foxx as that character, you know, the real nerdy, you know, wants friends and this kind of thing, very, you know, low self-esteem, this kind of thing, and the goofy hair, because Jamie Foxx in real life is a good looking guy, you know, super confident, and, you know, it's hard to believe him as that character. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
And it felt overdone a little bit. It felt like they were trying too hard to make this point about how he wants the limelight, or he wants, and his obsession with Spider-Man. Was that in the comics?
That I don't remember. He was a lot different character in the comics.
Yeah, it was. I'm not real sure about his motivation as the comic book character himself. I just always just remember he was always pissed off at Spider-Man.
Yeah, just like all the villains are, you know.
And I don't even know if it's rightly so pissed off. Like the whole thing about him, you know, Spider-Man's on all the big screens in downtown New York instead of him. And what did Spider-Man do to piss him off? I didn't really get it. Like it seemed like he was trying to.
He was more popular than him, and he found, I don't know. I didn't like that aspect of it. But before we get into the actual Electro, which that's the Electro part, every time he came up, I kept thinking Batman Forever, or Batman, not quite Batman and Robin, but it was close. It was definitely Batman Forever. Because his Max Dillon character, I mean, you remember like in the 90s when they tried so hard to make good-looking guys like Jamie Foxx seem like nerds? That's what it felt like. You're trying too hard to make this guy who's obviously cooler than everybody else in the movie, you're trying too hard to make him seem like he doesn't fit in.
Exactly.
The whole squiggly hair on his head and almost, I mean, all you're missing was like a pocket protector. And they even had the teeth thing. Oh, he's got messed up teeth, so he must be a nerd. You know, you didn't.
That was so dumb.
It was so dumb. You don't need to do that anymore. You don't.
They made a point of like zooming in when he transformed to that. Oh, we fixed the gap in his teeth.
Yep. Now he's cooler.
I was like, what? Why would you waste that 3 seconds to do that? Who cares about the gap in his teeth?
He shouldn't have had the gap to begin with. It didn't make any sense. And I know that's what the director was going for, but did anybody else feel like that? Like, you're getting a little too close to Batman and Robin territory for me with this character.
A little bit.
I did. I do remember thinking of Jim Carrey before he became the, was it the Riddler?
Yep.
Yeah, that's a really good comparison.
That's kind of what I flash back to, but I kind of liked his take on as Max Dillon. And I thought it was kind of neat to see him in a different role like that.
Did it make you feel cool?
No. But it was just, it was a bit over the top, and I think a bit cliche. There are a lot of the nerd cliches were rampant and everything, and that definitely could have been, you know, reeled back in a little bit. I thought they should have done a little bit better job of explaining why he, you know, why he wasn't maybe getting the recognition at work.
Absolutely,
The way he should have. I thought that would have been a little bit more information on that would have been helpful and made you empathize with him a little bit more on why he's so obsessed with being Spider-Man's friend and the attention. And they had that little scene where he's talking in the mirror and he's got, you know, Spider-Man stalking pictures all over his wall. So you obviously, you know, this guy's a, you know, he's walking on a thin line between sane and insane, but I think if a little bit more attention to that, again, with the 6 or 7 storylines, if you just take out 2 of them, at least 2 of them, if not 3 or 4, you can focus on that stuff and make him a much more interesting character. Mm-hmm. Because I think that plays a lot to him being the villain.
And one of the things, speaking of what you're talking about, that really, I kept thinking about it throughout the entire movie. If they would have stopped trying so hard to make him a nerd and that whole cheesy aspect that they took on the character, if they would have spent a little bit more time on the whole, he's a loner, he's a genius, because you don't really get the understanding that he's an electrical genius from this. It's just more, he's a really good handyman. He obviously knows electricity.
Yeah, he comes across more of a maintenance tech.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's not the character.
Electrical genius.
In the comics, that's the one thing I do remember. He's an electrical genius. He's a genius. He's not, I'm really good with extension cords. You know what I mean? I mean, he's a thorough genius.
I can hook up your home entertainment center like nobody else.
Exactly. I'm part of the Geek Squad, man. What's up? He's actually very talented in that aspect. You don't get that feeling. And if they would have focused more on that loner aspect, like they have that moment, and, well, I'll get to it in a second, but every time they focus on the fact that he's alone and he has this imaginary friend who's Spider-Man or whoever he sees and wants to be, those parts I thought resonated and helped to create a character. And then they would do something cheesy that took you completely off that track. And that's where the film lost me.
Well, again, you're doing it in a film. And, I, you know, when you read comics and that kind of thing, you're attached to these characters for longer periods of time, kind of like in a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
When you have to do all this in a 2-hour movie, instead you don't have time to really get a sense of what that character is going through because you have to do it so fast. You know what I'm saying? Like,
I do get what you're saying, and I think to Brian's point, if they would have cut 1 or 2 plot lines out, this would have worked so much better because they could have put more attention to developing him as a character. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
That's what they should have done. Now, after he's attacked by electric eels and they have that totally 3D effect of the angry eel coming at your face, how did he work as an actual villain, as Electro the villain? How did that work for you?
Well, did you see it in 3D? You said 3D.
I did not see it in 3D, but when that happened, I kept thinking, well, that's got to be cool 3D.
That was one of those key 3D scenes, right? I didn't see it in 3D either, but I remember thinking that too, like, I don't know if I want to pay the extra money just for that scene, but kind of wanted to see it in 3D.
It was almost like the Jaws 3 thing where the shark's coming at your face. You know, I'm like, right. Electric eel.
But it is one I almost want to see it a second time just to go see it in 3D because it looked really pretty. But anyway, back to the point we're talking about, did that transformation just seem so utterly cliche? I mean, everything about that, like, oh, we got to go fix this thing. Can you turn the power off so I'll be safe? No, I'm gone. I'm not going to turn that off for you. And then he plugs it in, and you're waiting for it to happen, and nothing happens, and then it does happen. And
that part I did like, where they set up the tension between, you know, about him plugging it up, and then he plugs it up, and he's like, okay, nothing. Oh, and then they pull the carpet out from underneath your feet, so to speak. So.
Right. But why are there electric eels at Oscorp? Is it like why they had spiders originally? They got rid of those and replaced them with electric eels?
these spiders are just too hard to control. You know, they're small. They get in places that you wouldn't normally look for. We can keep our eyes on eels if they're in a big tank.
Yeah, they're not going anywhere.
I thought that was a – I just kept thinking, like, this is – if you were to take this scene out, you could probably start a whole other sequel for Snakes on a Plane. maybe a sci-fi channel version or something of it, you know?
Oh, I like it. Keep talking. So. Sell it. Pitch it, man. Let's do this.
Eel-nado.
Oh,
Eel-nado. Like there you go. Eel-a-cane. You know, it's like it's just a hurricane of electric eels flying through Arkansas.
Do that in 3D. That would be a fantastic twister, like.
An eel-nami.
Ooh. Eel-quake.
Now that's...
Wait, no, that was Tremors. My bad.
That was a great sci-fi film, by the way.
Oh, I knew you were going to do it. I knew you were going to go there.
One of the best underrated sci-fi films of all time, really.
Yeah, really, when you think about it. One thing I – this is the part that I – going back to the loner thing I was talking about. When he has that moment, when Electro comes out and he has that few moments in the Times Square where he doesn't realize the power he has and he has no idea of what he's doing. He's trying to stop it. He has no idea how to control it. That's literally my favorite part of the movie because I thought they were going to go a little broader with this villain and maybe even a little bolder and make him somebody that doesn't mean to be a villain. You know, he has no understanding.
I don't want to hurt somebody. I don't want to hurt somebody, but I can't control this stuff. What is this? What am I doing? I don't want to do any of this, but I don't know what the hell's happening to me either.
Yeah, I love that. I thought that was great. And then they went the stereotypical cliched route.
It's like supervillain puberty. What's happening to me?
Well, I guess. Then he's got the lightning bolts. Yeah, I guess that works. Yeah.
Making a mess everywhere.
Yeah. And then he just has that moment where he snaps and, you know, Spider-Man's getting all the cameras and everything just shifts really quick. That's I think where the moment that's the moment where the character lost me a little bit. I mean, I kind of like the look, even though it's a little too neon powder blue for me. But you know, it works in the context of the movie. I don't think it works in the commercials. In the commercials, it looks horribly cheesy. But I think it works in the film. Mm-hmm. But what did you guys think of his rationale once we made the switch to I'm going to kill Spider-Man and everything else?
Kind of the same thing we talked before. It just happened too quick. The guy was maybe brilliant and that kind of thing, but he was a loner. He wasn't really an unhappy or angry guy, and it seemed like he got too angry for how little of issues happened. It just the switch flipped too quickly for me.
Yeah, I just kind of feel like it did the same thing. It's just all of a sudden, wait a minute, you know, he's so focused on trying to figure out what's, you know, why is electricity shooting out of everywhere. And now all of a sudden, oh, wait a minute, Spider-Man's up on that screen and that screen? Oh, hell no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now all of a sudden it's, I'm just angry. And that, I don't know, it just, that was kind of a weak transition for me. Yep. But I agree with you that that to me is like one of the most powerful scenes of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And probably my favorite.
And I feel bad, like we're talking so negative about this movie, but...
Well, there's a lot of negativity to be talked about with this movie.
Still loved it. I still really liked it a lot.
Hey, man, I'm glad that you liked it. I just liked it. I wish I could have loved it. I just thought there was so much going on that didn't work for me. And what about when we move on with Electro and we get into that huge fight at the end? Does anybody else understand exactly how they defeated him? Somebody explain that to me, because I guess I'm a little confused.
He got knocked out. So,
I think it was the concept of, well, he, you know, when Parker was trying out his little research and development stuff, he kept blowing up those batteries. So if it's over, you know, if he's overcharged, bam, you know, we're going to blow him up. Kind of like throwing, you can burn a fire out by basically just adding more fuel to it.
No, I understand that part of it, but how they actually achieved it?
I don't know. I was trying to just
keep up.
By that point, I was either like trying to keep up or wishing it would hurry up and end.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, the Green Goblin pops in almost at the last minute and causes Gwen's death. And that was a huge talking point for a lot of fans. A lot of people knew it was going to happen. Some people didn't know it was going to happen. I don't know. It's kind of hard. I think a lot of reviewers are really being a little too loose with that fact. And I actually read two different reviews where they said, with Gwen's death. I couldn't believe that they would actually put that in a film review. So I feel sorry for any of you guys that were spoiled by that. But how did the actual death work? I mean, did it work for you or did it not?
It totally worked for me. I may be in the minority, but the whole slow motion, he shoots that one last web to try to get her, and it looks like fingers are kind of reaching for her.
Oh, I love that fact. That effect was fantastic.
I loved it. And the fact that he caught her, but it wasn't like she just dropped or he missed.
She bounced.
I thought that was really... There was an emotional resonance from seeing that. It really mm-hmm. was. I mean, it was like and like you just really felt. I damn near welled up at that scene because I kind of saw it coming. I think I told you, Aaron. I called it when it kept showing Dennis Leary's character. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I think they're gonna kill her off. And even still, though I saw it coming, it tugged at my heart a little bit. I'm not gonna lie, it really worked for me.
It worked for me, and that was one of the things I just kind of kept waiting on was how are they going to do it, you know, when this absurd way of beating Electro finally happens. And mm-hmm. and it was, even though, like I said, I knew it was coming, and you know, with the whole clock tower thing, you just knew that was going to happen. But I like how they did it. Like I say, I agree with you where that slow motion of shooting that web and the fact that he actually did catch her, but not in time, which is... Mm-hmm. Of course, that's what everybody does. Everybody gets saved just at the last second, you know. Mm-hmm. And she didn't. She bounced.
And I got to tell you, when the web hit her, because I know how it played out in the comics, so in my head, oh, this is the moment where she's dead. And then the web hits her, and it looks like it gets a hold of her. I'm like, oh, they're not going to kill her off. I guess they're just playing the fans' expectations. But mm-hmm. then you see that bounce, and you're like, oh, shit. Mm-hmm. You know, my throat just dropped. Just dropped. And that's a compliment to Emma Stone's performance and Andrew Garfield and their chemistry. The fact that moment plays so well, especially with everything going on in this movie. There's so much. It's so busy. And the fact that moment still plays as harshly as it did, I thought was just saved the film. Just bounced it up, in my opinion, literally.
I couldn't. I see what you did there. I couldn't agree more. I think that scene worked so well because of the chemistry that they had in the first two-thirds of the movie, where the movie wasn't just a superhero movie. It actually it felt like a bit of a romance.
Yeah,
it really did. And then to wrap it up that way and really – when's the last superhero movie that you had that you got like that kind of an emotional response? I mean, that was impressive to me.
And the thing I like most, and we've talked about this in the Captain America spoiler cast, was – you know, the Marvel thing where they just can't kill anybody. You know, they kill them, but they bring them back or they come back in another form. You know, nobody's ever dead. Mm-hmm. I was so happy to see someone actually die. And mm-hmm. apparently the Spider-Man franchise is the only time when people really die. Because you've got her dad in the last movie and her now in this movie. It sounds horrible to say, but I'm glad that there are repercussions and consequences to what he's doing. And Peter Parker himself as a character has to have that. Because this is a kid with the world's weight on his shoulders, and it needs to resonate with him, and he constantly has to feel it to keep being as Spider-Man. He needs to feel it to keep being the Spider-Man we need him to be. Right. And I love that they pulled that off, because that could have just went wrong if they pulled it off wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, poor Gwen Stacy. We miss you already. Do you guys think they should introduce Mary Jane now in the next film, or should they stay off it for a while?
Well, I want to see Spider-Man do more hero stuff and not be so focused on a woman for a change.
Mm-hmm.
All of these movies, this is now five of them, mm-hmm. have revolved around his love interest.
Right.
I want to see a bigger picture. You know, with Captain America, his thing was against going against the Winter Soldier. But hey, you know what? There's a kind of an umbrella type of issue that's out there that he's got to fight. And I just don't think it's just still all revolves around him saving his girlfriend.
I agree.
when you get down to it. And there's none of these other movies, which are way more successful, are doing that. Not saying he can't have a love interest. I think that helps. But the movie can't revolve around somebody kidnapping his girlfriend again, or maybe she just bullies her way into the situation, which is basically what she did this time. Mm-hmm. But I just think, I'm tired of that. This is five movies in a row that this has happened.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more with you, Brian. It's just, take a break from it. You can introduce her and not have her be a huge love interest. You can have an emotional storyline with May. I mean, you've got her there. Use Sally Field, for crying out loud.
Absolutely.
And maybe in the next movie, because I know they're doing one more, I think it would be great, instead of having this huge Mary Jane relationship, which is what I'm worried they're going to do, just at the very end of the movie, or have her come up in different parts where you meet her as a character, and then at the very end of the movie, something leaves you with the feeling that they're going to end up together. You know, that, I think, would be the way to do the next movie. But hey, what do I know? You know, I also would have cut about 12 of these plot lines out. Now, what about the Rhino ending? Now, we had Rhino was kind of bookended, but they're definitely leaving you on the moment of Spider-Man's back in action. And we've got Rhino, not the Rhino from the comics, but a different kind of Rhino. How did you think that worked?
This was as atrocious as I kind of anticipated from the trailers. It wasn't as... It did throw me off that they kind of bookended the movie with Rhino, but from the beginning and the end. I do like that. It did make it a little bit different. I like the fact that they kind of used that, you know, to kind of get Spidey's head back in the game. But as far as the application of it, Paul Giamatti, one was wasted. They could have got anybody who can fake an Eastern European or Russian accent to do this.
I would argue that they didn't have someone that could fake a European accent, because I didn't buy that at all.
There you go. That's a good point. you didn't understand. I couldn't understand a word he was saying. There's the special effects of him in the suit was something that was probably on par with something that would happen in the 80s or early 90s.
Yeah, it wasn't well done, I didn't think.
Just looked unfinished or something. I mean, I've seen better special effects on video games.
Ooh, there you go, Scott. He's talking to you.
So that was just bad. And of course, you know, it leaves on that kind of high note of Spider-Man swinging the sewer lid or whatever it was. And you know, there's the big fight and everything, all that stuff. That was fine. But it just, oh God, they ruined that character. Ruined it.
But on the same token, you know, I get that you didn't like Rhino. I didn't like Rhino either. I loved the part with the little kid.
That was phenomenal. Yeah, the wind generator.
No, I mean at the end. I love the wind tunnel too, but I mean at the end where the little boy goes out because Spider-Man hasn't been around.
His little Tiananmen Square.
Yes, and he walks out there to fight Rhino. I thought that was I was like, aw.
That was very cool. Very cool.
I love the whole Rhino thing, to be honest with you. I don't have any attachment to the character from the comics. I understand now why we saw so little of him in the trailer.
Yeah, I think you saw all of him in the trailer.
That's what I'm saying. Everything that you saw him in was in the trailer. So I was so worried, though, that scene was going to be longer than it was. I was like, oh, man, we're going to have this now. I really hope – I remember thinking to myself, I really kind of hope they just – show like the fight start and then the credits roll. I think otherwise it would have been way too much. And they did, and I was so relieved that they did that, especially because I think it'll be a cool lead in for the third movie. You basically could start the third movie at that exact shot, have the opening thing be that fight, and I think that would be cool.
Yeah, I mean that would be you kind of see how it plays out, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of stuff. I just, oh my gosh, that was just a horrible character. I don't necessarily need the guy who's in a, you know, maybe in the rhino skin suit that was permanently fused to his body like in the comics. But I don't know. Maybe that would have, they could have come up with something to make that work.
Yeah. Didn't the Wolverine teach us that mech suits don't work? They just, they don't lend itself themselves to film that well, unless it's Pacific Rim. I don't want to see it.
Yeah.
I just don't. So what do you guys like better or worse? Let's talk about the Raimi films versus the Webb films, which, what a name. What do you like better or worse about Mark Webb's films versus Raimi's originals?
The main difference for me is, well, there's no Tobey Maguire, but that aside,
You really didn't like Tobey, did you?
No, I did not. I thought to a certain extent he played he was a good choice for like the Peter Parker aspect, but because he kind of had that naive, nerdy look about him. But outside of that, after the first one or so, it just, he was bad. But that aside, the Raimi ones just felt more campy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And the Mark Webb ones feel a little bit more grounded in current times or whatever. It didn't feel as over the top. Even though there are some absurd moments, don't get me wrong, but it just, there's a certain more groundedness to it. And I like the fact that he actually plays what I think of Spider-Man more in his movies versus Raimi's, that opening scene with Spider-Man, where, like you said, that was a Spider-Man that I know, the wisecracking, you know, he's got stuff, all kinds of things flying at him and dodging sewer lids and corners of buildings and cars and stuff. And he's cracking jokes. That was Spider-Man. And I didn't get that as much in the Raimi versions.
There's just a very little bit of it, I think, in the Raimi ones. Like when he fought, what was it, Macho Man, Randy yeah. Savage or whatever, mm-hmm. he had a couple really good lines there, and that seemed like that was it. Mm-hmm. In this one, it seems more like it's more part of the character. Every time he's in that suit, he's cracking jokes, he's making some comments, and it's just cool to watch.
I gotta say, even though I firmly believe that the Raimi movies are better than these two. I don't dislike these two. I like the last Amazing Spider-Man better than I like this Amazing Spider-Man, but I like both of them. But I love the originals, especially the first two. But I will say that I think Andrew Garfield is a better Spider-Man because, like you guys say, when he's in the suit, the jokes work. And I didn't think Maguire had a good knack for telling the wisecracks. That was always my only issue with him as Peter Parker, that and the fact that he cried like a girl. But when he's in the suit, when Andrew Garfield's in the suit, everything he does feels just like Spider-Man. It feels like this is the Spider-Man I grew up with. The jokes are pretty funny. They're on point. The little moment, like we were talking about briefly with the kid whose wind tunnel project breaks and he puts it back together and then walks him to school or whatever. That was such a Spider-Man moment. Mm-hmm. And absolutely loved it. The opening fight was fantastic. The ending fight, minus the cheesy special effects and Paul Giamatti just going for cheese ball of the year. The actual Spider-Man showing up and telling that kid, I got it from here. That was a total Spider-Man moment. He just is Spider-Man in my book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think personally, if you put Andrew Garfield into Raimi's Spider-Man, I think he got the best movie ever made.
Let me ask this. Speaking of that last scene with the kid,
mm-hmm.
what cop is going to let that kid run out there?
Yeah.
A really bad one.
I mean, there's like, I don't know, half a dozen cops standing around holding back the crowd. I mean, what cop is not going to go, all right, this is a bad idea to let this kid walk out here. I should probably step up and go get him.
Well, yeah. And to that point, what villain is going to sit there in the street and let Spider-Man and this kid have this
conversation
and doing nothing?
Now I think we are picking it apart a little bit when you start when you start talking about the logical aspirations of Peter Parker and this kid talking on the street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Rhino just sitting there going, all right, you guys want to wrap this conversation up? Because I got some menace to start provoking. Let's go. Okay.
What do you guys think of I like the suit in the new movie way better than the old one. What do you guys think?
The old one felt more original. I guess it held more to the source material for me. So I guess nostalgia's glasses on that one for me.
Mm-hmm. I just think that the one in the recent films just looks sleeker.
It looks more modern, but it doesn't look as timeless to me. I will say Green Goblin, even though I think it was cheesy how quickly he became Green Goblin, probably looks a little better than that stupid
than
mask.
The shiny,
yeah.
The shiny metal suit.
Yeah, as much as I like Willem Dafoe, the mask never really worked because, you know, it doesn't translate to film. I know it's from the comics, but it just doesn't translate to film.
I agree.
You know, it looked like a Mighty Morphin Power Ranger type deal, and
that's a good explanation of it.
Yeah.
Especially because when he had the mask on, you could see his. There's something that was distracting about seeing his eyes and his mouth moving behind the mask that bothered me for some reason.
But the mask isn't necessarily moving like.
Yeah. Yeah, because the Halloween masks don't move. So
right.
He's got all this technology and he can't get a mask that conforms to his face. I don't know. It's just a. But I still love that movie. That's my favorite Spider-Man movie from easily. But now, does this series, the new series, the Amazing Spider-Man series, does it stand on its own 2 feet? I know we kind of had some nitpicks about it, but overall, like I said, Scott loved it. Brian and I liked it. Do you think the series stands on its own yet?
To me, it does. I think they've proven that they can take that universe and set it in a little bit more reality, so to speak, even though we had a lot of problems, like I said. I think that they're showing that, yeah, we're for real and we're going to take some risks. I mean, obviously Gwen Stacy was killed off in the comics, you said, but the fact that they actually did it in the story and really gave you that emotional response, I think sets this series where it needs to be. And like you said, on its own 2 feet. Do you guys agree or no?
You can't help but compare the previous three versus these two, just because they're really so close together in time frames, but it's definitely strong enough to stand on its own, and you don't feel like you're missing necessarily anything from the first rendition. So it's strong, and you've got great people in it. It's just, gosh, just focus.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Just focus. Narrow it down a little bit. I don't need 40 villains introduced. I don't need all kinds of other dead people that are well dead that don't really pertain to the rest of the movie getting 10 minutes of screen time.
Right.
I'm in the same boat. I like the reinvention. I think you got a great actor in Andrew Garfield. You got great actor in Sally Field. And while you used to have a good actor in Emma Stone, but she did. She bounces. So I would like to see in the third movie, just rein it in a little bit, you know, tell a smaller story or something and make the emotional core just be the Aunt May storyline. You don't need a girlfriend. You don't need that distraction anymore. The series stands on its own. I mean, you've got a good director who can tell he was good with the action. He's really got a good visual take on Spider-Man's flight. You know what I mean? When you're
yes.
in Spider-Man's suit and you're zipping through the city, I feel like I'm Spider-Man. There's moments of the film where I feel like mm-hmm. I am Spider-Man, which I didn't get from the Raimi movies because of special effects, probably mostly. But in this one, you know, you've got that first person shot or third person, whatever it is, where he's zipping around. It works beautifully. When he's fighting crime, I mean, it works beautifully. There are aspects that work wonderful. Just squeeze out all the extra crap you don't need. And I think you got a perfect Spider-Man movie, personally. Now, we know they're trying to introduce the Sinister Six. But who do you guys want in the next movie for a villain? Do you want somebody we've already seen, like in the original trilogy, or do you want somebody completely new?
Well, the main one, I think most of the Sinister Six kind of translates to the traditionally kind of campy animal type characters, like the Vulture and Dr. Octopus, which is what they alluded to a couple of times. But the one, and even though I complained about too many characters and all kinds of villains and stuff, the one that I want to see introduced, and I got to imagine most other people do too, is and that's Venom.
Yeah, done right.
Yeah.
Done right.
He's really almost the villain version of Wolverine in the sense that he's not a good guy. This guy is an outright villain, but you can't help but pull for him. And I think if they're going to get the Sinister Six, and they're all going to gang up on Spider-Man at some point, which is inevitably going to happen. He's going to have some help. Now, if he doesn't have help from the Avengers or the X-Men, something from a different studio, which they're obviously having issues with, they've got to give him some help from somewhere. And if you're going to draw somebody from his own universe, you might as well bring in Venom somehow. I don't think he necessarily has to do it in a way where Spider-Man gets the symbiotic costume and then tries to get rid of it. And then Eddie Brock, I believe his name is, ends up with it, and you know, it becomes a part of him.
Yeah, we saw that movie. His spidey sense is tingling, if you know what I mean. God.
You know, so I don't think they necessarily have to do it that way. You could just have it where Brock finds it somehow and, you know, goes from there or something. I don't know, but I think Venom, or I think Venom would be the really the best thing that could really kind of happen as far as introducing a new villain.
I agree, and they can do it right.
Mm-hmm.
God, they jacked it up in the third movie.
Yes,
to me.
They did. Oh my God.
Oh, it was so bad. And I'm with you too on Dr. Octopus. I think they alluded to that too much in this film. Like, I kind of wish they would have let that be a little bit more of a teaser than they showed it like three times.
Which, what did they show three times?
The Dr. Octopus.
Dr. Octopus.
The suit.
Oh, yeah.
It was like, yeah. we
and
get
the vulture.
It.
The wings for the vulture.
And I didn't know what that was. That's from the comics, I assume.
That is not an exciting villain, let me tell you.
Yeah.
No?
It's like a bald-headed, middle-aged guy with
flying around
a green, green suit with wings on it. So
yeah, that's not a supervillain in my world. I'm with you guys. I think Venom. I love Doc Ock. I thought he was already done well in the second Spider-Man. So I don't want to see a repeat. And you know, I actually liked the Sandman in Spider-Man 3. I thought Thomas Hayden Church did a good job. I thought they were on the right path. The character, they just tried to ram too much in, and then they ruined him at the end. But man, Venom is such a good character in the comics, and he's such an awesome villain. And you could just tell Sam Raimi didn't want to do it in Spider-Man 3. It's almost like every time they show him, it's him going, screw you, studio. You know what I mean? I mean, it's that poorly done. But man, the effects are there. Just think how awesome that could be if they could nail it.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I would like to see that myself. So guys, rank them. Give us your order. All five Spider-Man movies, all five of them. Tell us your ranking from best to worst.
I'll start up. I loved the Amazing Spider-Man 2 that we just watched. Loved it, but I did not like it as much as I liked Spider-Man 2, the Sam Raimi one. To me, I loved the original Spider-Man, but when the second one came out, it just blew me away. It was one of those midnight release things I couldn't wait to see and totally enjoyed it. Second, I would do Amazing Spider-Man 2, followed by the original Spider-Man. And then The Amazing Spider-Man, and then Spider-Man 3 last.
Brian?
Oh, I've got to go with the first Sam Raimi Spider-Man, just because that was probably more with the emotion I got from it, because that was the first time it was kind of like, wow, Spider-Man has been done right.
Mm-hmm.
The origin start parts of it had all the high notes of that, even the with great power comes great responsibility, the wrestling thing. I mean, it basically stayed pretty straight to the comic books. It was a great interpretation of it. Next, for similar reasons, just amazing, you know, the Amazing Spider-Man first one, the Andrew Garfield, because I think that Andrew Garfield is a much better Peter Parker / Spider-Man, and this was more grounded. So that would probably be my second one. The third one is Spider-Man 2, then Spider-Man 3, and Amazing Spider-Man 2 would be my last
one. Ooh, you put Amazing Spider-Man 2 after Spider-Man 3, huh?
I think if you take out that emo scene, the movie plays a lot better.
I agree with that, actually. I just rewatched it, and I'm totally on board with that.
So to make Amazing Spider-Man 2 a lot better, you've got to take out probably 30 to 45 minutes of movie.
Ouch.
Maybe 45 is a bit high, but 20 to 30 minutes, easy. You could cut that out or fill that with other exposition of other stories, and it will be a heck of a lot better. You've got to make a lot more changes to this one than you would Spider-Man 3.
I'm going with Sam Raimi's version of Spider-Man. The first one is my favorite. That's in my top five movies ever. I love that movie. Spider-Man 2 is my number two. Then I would go Amazing Spider-Man because I liked Andrew Garfield quite a bit, even though I didn't think the Lizard was very compelling. Then I go to Amazing Spider-Man 2, which is just barely beating out Spider-Man 3. And I agree with Brian that if they took all that emo crap out, like him smacking Mary Jane and dancing every chance he gets, just take out every aspect of emo and maybe replace Eddie Brock with somebody that can act. And I think you've got a great movie. And that's really all that was missing. So, but I liked all of them. And, you know, there wasn't one that I loathed. I never loathed Spider-Man 3, unlike some people that say it's the worst movie. Seriously, if you think it's worse than Batman and Robin or Batman Forever, I don't even want to know you, really. Because those are just better movies. And let me ask you guys, I mean, that's kind of all the Spider-Man talk you could muster for one episode. But are you looking forward to the third movie?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm more high on this movie than you guys are. I can't wait for another one. I'm actually considering going to see it again to see it in 3D.
Ooh.
Yeah, I actually, Scott, I kind of agree with you on that. You know, in that vein, I wouldn't mind seeing this again just to see the 3D, you know, the 3D parts of it, because I felt like I was missing something. Probably, you know, in some of those scenes, whether it was a fight scene or just traveling around the city, or maybe just that free falling type thing it was doing.
Yeah.
So I'm curious as to how that would look in 3D.
Plus, like you said, there's a couple areas in the movie where you can tell that, oh, that's for the 3D version.
Yeah. The clock tower scene with all the different gears falling. Yep. And you know, that, and to kind of flash back to Hugo, that was one of my just best moments as far as 3D was, there was a scene in a clock tower where the kid enters the clock tower at the bottom and crawls up towards you. And then right before he gets to your face, he bugs out to the side of the screen. So, and that's kind of what I thought about in that scene. And yeah, I would like to see it. And I'm anxious for the third one. I think with some of these characters, I think they've kind of been building slowly with this mysterious man in the hat, which I think is Mysterio personally.
I hope so.
He's kind of the, what is it? He's kind of the guy that rounds up the Sinister Six, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
I'm anxious for it. I mean, I really think, I just want them to, again, focus on two or three plot lines at the most and not let it revolve around the girlfriend. Do that.
Yep.
And it will be amazing.
I'm with you guys, and I do want to bring up, because we didn't really mention it, but that score, I did not like the score at
all. I didn't either.
Oh, my God. There's so much synth pop or whatever the hell was going on mm-hmm. with that, and it was just so cheesy. And there are moments where I'm like, all right, this works, and then there's other moments where I thought they pulled the score from the wrong movie.
Yeah, I felt exactly the same way.
Yeah, you're a big music guy. Didn't you think it was a little cheesy?
Was it the same theme from the first movie?
Hell no. No, not even.
It didn't feel like it at all. It just felt totally out of place. Really out of place.
And it was from Hans Zimmer. But then they also brought in Pharrell Williams. I mean, I don't know why he's there. I mean, do you want to do a happy version of Spider-Man? I don't know.
They all want to wear green hats.
Ooh, that would turn it up a little bit. I just didn't change the score. Whatever you guys did, go back to the orchestral version, because we needed more orchestra, less Axel Foley. Because that just did not work for me.
Right.
And in closing, the X-Men stinger. What a piece of shit marketing ploy if I've ever seen one.
That was embarrassing.
Wasn't it? I mean, I get it. Hey, they're different studios. They're working together. But it was awful. There's nothing to do with the Spider-Man movie itself.
And I think you and I talked about this a little bit the other day, Aaron. To me, that the stinger in the Marvel movie is become a staple. Mm-hmm. Something that you look forward to, like everybody stays after the credits now just to see what it is. And the fact that they turned it into an advertisement for a completely unrelated series just felt like a complete slap in the face. Like, screw you guys. Like, seriously, like, it just really bothered me.
It was a huge slap in the face. I'm just sitting there watching it going, this might be cool. This might be cool. Oh, it's not. Not all. Not even a little bit. Nope.
Mm-mm. Yeah. I mean, I would take the at the end of the Avengers, that little scene where they're the
shawarma
scene.
Yeah.
That, you know, that didn't really have anything to do with the story, but I would take that over an ad.
At least, you know, it played off of something that was mentioned in the movie.
Exactly.
And it was just, it was hilarious. Even though not a word was said, it was just kind of, these superheroes are just kind of sitting down and, you know,
having a snack.
having a snack. Like, dang, whew, worked up an appetite with that one.
Plus, why?
But we're also ass whipped that we can't even we can't even have a conversation right now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And like I say, it was a total slap in the face there as far as the X-Men stuff. And again, it was in Vietnam, so it's Peter Parker wasn't even thought of yet.
Right. And why is it necessary to have that advertisement there? Because those that are going to stick around for that credit scene are hardcore comic book movie fans.
Usually.
You don't have to remind us that an X-Men movie is coming out in 3 weeks.
Exactly. It's just completely unnecessary. We're all going to go see it. The kind of person that's going to stick around through those credits are the people that are going to go see every comic book movie. So it was like a complete wasted advertisement.
And I didn't even understand it. The only thing I can think of is, you know, Fox gave Sony a huge paycheck to play it.
Yep.
That's all I could think. It was total BS marketing. Ugh. That's all right. The movie was still good. It's just not as good as it could have been. So hopefully we didn't poo-poo it for you guys that are fans. But, you know, many of our listeners asked us to do this, and we kind of thought we would be coming to this telling you so many high points, but there's a lot of stuff that deserves a lot of negative talk. I'm sorry. We're not trying to shit on the movie. We're just saying this is the truth of what we thought, and we honestly think a lot of you probably feel the same way. So let us know if you disagree.
They will.
Oh, yeah, they will. I want to thank all you guys for listening to our special Amazing Spider-Man episode. Our next one, I believe, is going to be for X-Men, which Scott can't wait for. He'll probably even get to moderate it just because he's so excited about it.
Oh, I can't wait.
So let us know if you like these extra episodes, and if we can get enough positive feedback, we'll look at doing them continuously for big films. Big films. We're not going to do them for everything. We hope you enjoyed it, and thanks again, Scotty and Brian.
Enjoyed it. It was a good time.
Remember, you can find The Hollywood Outsider at thehollywoodoutsider.com. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, or just throw in our RSS feed to whatever podcatching device you use. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thehollywoodoutsider. You can tweet us at @H_outsider. Email is feedback@thehollywoodoutsider.com, or you can call and leave us a message or text us at 818-814-6246. Remember, guys, the next time you go to a theater, buy popcorn.
Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes a Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud, he's got radioactive blood. Can he swing from a thread? Take a look overhead. Hey there goes a Spider-Man. In the chill of night, at the scene of a crime, like a streak of light, he arrives just in time. Spider-Man, Spider-Man, friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. Wealth and fame, he's ignored. Action is his reward to him. Life is a great big day. Wherever there's a hang-up, you'll find a Spider-Man.